quick concluding remarks. It's a Friday evening. Thank you all for attending and for making this a fascinating and very enjoyable event. Lisa McKenzie couldn't make it here today. In her book, Getting By, talks about her chance reading of George Orwell's Road to Wigan Pier, aged 16, as a revelation. The book was given to her by a visitor from whom, during the time of the miners' strike in 1984, had visited her Nottinghamshire home, one of many visitors, as she puts it, from odd places offering support. The books, histories, narratives, artefacts, and ephemera of past working class struggles, even if written by an outside observer like Orwell, are what inspired or drove many of us here today to take a long-term interest in, or indeed a passionate commitment to, the politics and culture of working class life. As Danny Dorling advises in his introduction to Lisa's book, the issues McKenzie identified in Orwell are as relevant today. People are getting by, but it's getting much worse at the bottom, he writes. And you, by which he presumably means the more well-off reader, take from that what you will, are unlikely to know the half of it because that is the way it currently is. Britain is once again as economically unequal as it was when Orwell was writing in the 1930s. The best off 1% once again take 15% of all income. In the years in between, we came together and then fell apart. We came together before, when we began to recognise just how bad the repercussions of falling apart really are. There are worse things than getting by, and we are currently heading towards them. In the spirit of this day's events about cross-currents in British and Irish working-class life, it is fitting to note that these observations of a British context are just as relevant anywhere in this island. Indeed, when Dorling argues that we are unlikely to know the half of it, we might immediately think of the decision by the Irish courts yesterday to allow the billionaire media mogul and Irish water enthusiast Dennis O'Brien to have a ban put on what seems to have been a fairly timid RTE report about his finances. But if rich media owners have the power to control a good degree of what is reported in the news, McKenzie's anecdote points to a longer-term access issue, or an epistemic one, if we're to put it in the more academic terms. What if she hadn't read Orwell? What if so many of us here today hadn't chanced upon that key text or person, often a teacher, who let us glimpse behind the wizard's curtain that shields us from some of the harsher truths about our society, capitalism, exploitation, and also the proud tradition of struggle against those ills? In my own broad area of cultural studies, and more specifically the study of literature, it is fair to say that Marxist and more generally left-wing scholars have shown far less interest in cultural representations of the working class than they might have. By contrast, as Andrew Milner and Jeff Browis have observed, feminist theory, for example, was often led by literary scholars who viewed culture as a vital element in the development of women's rights. Independent publishing houses like Virago endeavoured to forge a feminist view of the world in letters. This was counter-hegemony in action, the kind of thing Antonio Gramsci spoke of when he said that just as the working class has thought to organise itself politically and economically, it should also think about organising itself culturally. By contrast, Milner and Browett argue there is no real counterpart within contemporary Marxist cultural theory to the feminist practice of the discovery and celebration of the literatures of the oppressed. Marxist writers seem surprisingly uninterested in the creativity of proletarian culture, an indifference which speaks volumes surely about the actual distance between their interests and those of the class that they may be occasionally claimed to represent. Milner and Browett may, of course, be ignoring or undermining the many valiant efforts of those on the left to develop a genuinely working class counterculture, evident in everything from theatre to punk to poetry. But there is truth nonetheless in their emphasis on the lack of focus on creating an archive of working class culture, of developing a canon of writing and film and multifarious cultural artefacts that are already there. And indeed, it is a rich lineage and one we can share across ethno-national lines, as evident here today. Not only does the work of scholarship across the humanities on the history, politics and culture of working class life provide a vital lifeline for the left, it also provides the building blocks of class consciousness and what we might even say, at a time when the working class is so vilified on these islands, class pride. As John Berger puts it, the pride with which a class force sees itself recognisably depicted in a permanent art is full of pleasure. Even if the art is flawed and the truth harsh, the depiction gives a historic resonance to their lives. A pride which was before an obstinate refusal of shame becomes an affirmation. Narrative is increasingly recognised as key to our cultural and identity formation. Daniel Dennett conceptualises our consciousness as a centre of narrative gravity. The very essence of consciousness is the stories we tell ourselves. The same might be said of class consciousness, or, as Clifford Geertz put it after Max Weber, man is an animal suspended in webs of significance he himself has spun. If the point made by Berger that art can make us feel class consciousness in a way that transforms class shame into class pride is right, then surely the left ought to be attending to such matters more rigorously. Class shame is, after all, a key feature of the current climate. Here at Queen's, our group has engaged in a number of initiatives around education, knowledge exchange, archival preservation and historical excavation in regard to working class life. Our group, kindly funded by the Institute of Collaborative Research in the Humanities, has been able to bring seminars to community venues. We've had talks over the last year on labour and loyalism, trade unions and conflict, music and working class life, and an inaugural Margaret McCubry lecture, all in community venues, along with discussion and debate on the future of our collective studies inside Queen's. Today we've had some wonderful talks from Adrian Grant, who talked about some of the lessons for history today, perhaps, from the timid development of labour almost a century ago. Matt Collins challenging the historiography of events which will be receiving their 50th anniversary in a couple of years' time. We had Sean O'Connell talk about the importance of and questions around, and the problematic questions around democratising history through oral history. Chris Borges talked about the wonderful work being done in Manchester in terms of archiving and preserving and presenting working class life. Phil Scraton on the demonisation of the Liverpool working class, which is so relevant today. Mike Morris talked about George Garris in a wonderfully, I thought, engaging feast for the eyes and ears of a presentation. We had Kira talking about Belfast Exposed and some of that very provocative work, which I thought she talked about the reanimation of some of these things, and also those haunting images and the juxtaposition of that with the talk about habituation. I thought was very provocative and interesting as the conversation which came after it showed. And she talked about going into no-go areas and the origins of Belfast Exposed, and I think the importance of the work we're doing is perhaps going beyond no-go areas for academia. Funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs in Dublin and in conjunction with Trademark Belfast, Dr. Sean Byers, Dr. Stephen Nolan and myself have been working on a project identifying the archives of working class history, literature and cultural production that are available for further exploration here in the north. There is much more work to be done, of which we are all acutely aware, but I think this work and the work of our group here today is very important in terms of building the case for something along the lines of the wonderful People's History Museum that people have as a wonderful resource for their own archives, for family archives in Britain. I would like to end this day by thanking you for being here today, for your support, by thanking our fantastic speakers, panellists, musicians and singers, Hugh Jordan, of course, and his wonderful music. The person who did much of the organising here today, Sophie Long, my fellow group members and our group leader, Graham Walker, and the staff here at the QFT, and of course NVTV and Alan, who very kindly are doing all sorts of things to publicise the work. I'd also like to thank those of you who have time. I would also like to ask those of you who have time, energy, contacts, resources, ideas, and we didn't really get to discuss those ideas at the end, and I'm sure some of your heads are buzzing with them, or just a keen interest in working class history to help us in this endeavour to discuss, unearth, curate, disseminate and repopularise texts, stories and histories of working class life. It's important that the Lisa McKenzies of the future have those chance encounters that spark such passion for social and cultural change, because we want to do more than, as the title of our book goes, get by. As James Connolly put it, for our demands, most moderate are, we only want the earth. Thank you.